This is the American Fashion Podcast, the fashion industry's favorite show, our weekly look under the hood of the fashion business. Don't miss the show notes for links to books, videos, and brands mentioned in each episode, as well as a link to AmericanFashionPodcast.com, where you can find more information about the series, hosts, and how to be a guest. You'll also find a link to an archive of hundreds of episodes going back to 2014, which include interviews with top designers, insights for beginners on building a brand, sustainability tips, deep thoughts, and all kinds of amazing detail about how this industry functions in all the little niches from a broad range of leaders and experts.
This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith, here with Kathy Sheppas.
Hi, everyone.
And our guest in the studio is the CEO and founder of Canvas and Hyde, Lisa Pongrass. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Charles.
So you are...
And Kathy.
You are making handbags in Brooklyn and Italy.
I am.
You're making handbags in Brooklyn. This is cool. You're doing leather handbags in Brooklyn. That's unusual. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got to doing that?
Okay. Well, when I started this business, I was looking for a manufacturer, and finding a great skilled craftsman who can make beautiful bags is like women finding a fabulous hair colorist. It's impossible, but once you find one, you hold on to them. And in fact, we've become great friends, and my office is in his factory. So I'm really hands-on with everything that we make. I'm there on the spot. I'm able to watch and oversee everything from the edge painting to cutting the skins and positioning the dyes onto the leather. And I'm very lucky to have found someone who's been making bags for 30 years.
And how did you get into making bags? Why was this a thing for you?
So about 4 years ago, I started the business. And, you know, I came to live in America in 2008. And I never understood why, when you think of luxury handbags, you don't really think of American-made. You think of Italian and French and maybe Spanish. But this is such a great country. You guys do everything. Why couldn't we make beautifully finished, incredibly luxury handbags here. Incredible luxury. So I set about trying to do it. And I get it now after spending several years exploring. I get that the skills and the craftsmanship left. I mean, people didn't do it when people started mass producing in China and offshore. That skill set kind of dissolved in a little bit of a way here.
Yeah, it didn't get passed on to the next generation.
No.
So there's a generation that doesn't have that knowledge, and the people who do are aging out of the workforce.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Some's getting passed on. Some is making it through, which is kind of a sign of hope. But there will never be a time where New York City's largest industry is the garment business again. This is not a thing because cities won't specialize in that way. No one's going to specialize in that
way.
I don't know that it's sad. I think it's kind of human progress. I mean, we don't need that many people making clothing to make clothing.
Do you feel like they're hiring new people often? Like who's...
So my manufacturer has people that work for him, and he does pass on his tricks of the trade, and then he keeps his people close by. I think there's a little bit of a resurgence. I think there is a movement back to making beautiful things, and this disposable fashion, I think a lot of people don't want that. I certainly don't want that. And I think that I'm not alone. I think there are a lot of people like me who want to make beautiful things, whether it's garments or couture or bespoke shoes or leather handbags. So I think maybe there's a resurgence here.
So you came here in 2008, which mm-hmm. was a very memorable year.
Very.
Or one we would like to forget. So how, and your background was more interior, if I recall right, and public relations. Mm-hmm. So how did you see the market here? I know you were just describing, you know, so many bags made in Europe, but how did you see the market that made you see an opportunity? And maybe also just talk about what niche you see your bags filling. Kind of describe them a little bit too, because they're very like cool luxury.
Okay, that's a kind of a three-pronged question in a way. 2008 was a terrible year for the whole world, I guess. But Obama came into office, and I was very happy to see that. New York was just a fabulous place to come to. Everyone was so happy and excited. But I think that the financial crisis really stifled the sales of a lot of luxury brands, and retailers struggled. I mean, retail has continued to struggle. It's been super challenging since then. Retailers are trying to find their way with online sales and flagship stores. I didn't actually think about making handbags in 2008 at all. That wasn't my path. I didn't incorporate this business until the end of 2015. Okay. So mm-hmm. my journey was to see that I couldn't find, you know, there are lots of small emerging brands, but I wanted something that was really timeless, incredibly elegant, and something that would, that really last and was not seasonal at all, you know, not something that would be recognized as a particular bag from a particular season. So
do you have a lot of seasons, or are you carrying bags that kind of stay on your collection season in, season out? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just bringing in November the crossbody bag that's my best-selling bag with linen on the front. So that will be fall and summer. Black, I guess, will be for fall, and the beige will be more of a summer line. Because I sell all over America, it's so different. Like in Florida, they're buying tan bags all year. And in Colorado or places like that, it, you know, it's much more the heavier colors. So I try to do timeless works everywhere.
So color tends to be tied to the weather or the climate? Or is it the temperament?
The climate, probably. I mean, in Florida, I sell the lightest bags. And in New York, black is still my biggest seller.
If you're in Miami when it's warm, you're like, can't even wear black. You feel
exactly
really strange. So especially in your bag or shoes.
Yeah. I wear black all the time.
What else did you kind of learn from across the country? Like, so what was your path then to building your business?
Wow, it's just been, it's kind of been the most incredible journey. The path to building has been like making mistakes and taking three steps forward and two steps back. I didn't have any experience in manufacturing at all. And I guess if someone had said to me now, like, would you do it all over again? I'd be a little more trepidatious. But I went in completely blind and thinking, how hard can it be? Well, let me tell you, it's pretty hard, but I've learned that just through making mistakes. Luckily, not drastic mistakes, but just – and finding good people, other people, listening to what other people have to say, sitting down with people who've been in the industry a lot longer than I have. That's been amazing.
And what are you learning from customers? Like, how has that helped you? Because you're in a number of specialty stores, mm-hmm. so that's – that's very different feedback, right, than what you might get
very
just
different.
Through e-com. So how has that helped?
So I love listening to what my customers have to say. And, you know, in the beginning, I wanted to be everything to everyone. And I realized that's a huge mistake. You cannot make everyone happy with one bag. One of the things that has been really interesting is that I come from Australia and I'm fairly tall. I'm 5'8". I'm not incredibly tall. But trying to make a crossbody that fits a woman who's 5'2 and a woman who's 6'2 has been quite challenging. So I needed adjustability on the straps, for example, without making various sizes of the
bags. I would
have
never thought of that.
Yeah.
I mean, you think of length and clothing, but yeah, I wouldn't have thought of that
with
the crossbody.
It's interesting because if you have too much adjustability on a strap, then it flaps and you don't want that excess leather. And if you don't have enough, then people can't wear it at the particular point on the body they want to wear it. So, I mean, that's an example, one example of me trying to listen to the feedback of my customers and the retailers. I work very closely with my retailers and hear what they have to say.
So if your background was in promotion, then how did you get design skills?
Someone actually asked me the other day, oh, did you go to design school? And, you know, I don't know. No.
How do you design? What's your approach? Do you talk it out to somebody, or do you sketch? What how does it work?
So I'll give you an example with one of my clutches. I actually went to the Cooper Hewitt Museum with a friend, and they had an Art Deco exhibition, and I went back to my office and I started drawing the shapes of the Art Deco arches, very triangular but soft lines. And then in my head I saw the bag. I just didn't know how to articulate that to someone else. So I got some cardboard and I cut it, and then I got some leather and I cut that and stuck it onto the cardboard, and then I stapled, because I didn't know whether to stick it with sticky tape, I stapled it until I had like a sort of a simple prototype of what I wanted, which is maybe what students at FIT do. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like it just came naturally.
It kind of did.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you where that came from, but that's how I did it. And I took it to my manufacturer, and then he was able to make a little pattern. And yeah, that's kind of the crossbody. My inspiration from that came from a bag that I got at a flea market years ago that was for a newspaper boy. It was all in canvas, and the newspaper boys back in the day would wear them, stick their newspapers in, and just throw them into someone's yard. And so this is a hybrid, I guess, of something like that. Very different, but that was my inspiration.
So, and do you find that customers are interested in the quality or how you're making your bags differently than maybe other people? Like,
so they,
other than, I mean, we
they
know
do.
They look
they
for the
do
story.
They do care about the quality. Certainly at my price point, they want to know almost why.
What is your price point?
So this one, the crossbody, retails for $11.85 US.
And is that typical across your lines?
So it's more expensive than, say, Tommy Hilfiger or Michael Kors, but less expensive than Celine, Balenciaga, and Gucci.
So but you have an opening price point of like $600?
$580, yeah, is the opening price point. This is by far our bestseller now. But back to what you asked about people, they do want to know about quality. They like to hear that the hardware on the bag won't tarnish because it's nickel-plated brass. They like to hear that, and that the leather is Italian, and that the stitching is German thread. Yeah.
So what's with the German thread? Like, is that something to look for, or how do you? What is it? It's just sturdier than most threads, or
it's the best quality. It's the highest grade. It's the thickest. It's beautiful. It's, you know, like making a bag is like making a meal. You can use subpar ingredients or the best ingredients. And for me, there's a very big difference in using absolute quality in everything. And a learning curve too. I mean, the Weekender bag I do, you can buy rope to put in the handle of the Weekender bag. And no one would ever know if I used the cheap rope, but I would.
Right.
And it wouldn't last the same way and wouldn't feel as good. And so I use this amazing Italian rope.
So now what about where are you at in terms of sustainability in your product?
So it's so interesting. It's a word. Sustainability is something that people use a lot and
make it a simple question, but it's really a big answer.
Yeah. I mean, what is sustainability? Is it the balance of being able to use something from nature but make sure we don't deplete it? So I had to research this and learn a lot about the factories that I work with. One of the things I do is I buy leather from people who are environmentally compliant, which means that the chemical runoff and everything that they use when they tan the skins doesn't go into the earth or into a water supply. They're very careful about the way they dispose of any waste, and that's in Italy. So I use them. I try to use everything that is as good and as clean as I possibly can. The skins, I handpick the skins in Miami, actually. There's a great factory there, and I go down and handpick them. And they're from Brazil and Argentina. It's kind of hard unless you actually go and visit the places. You have to take their word for it.
Right.
I mean, it's like buying something that's organic. You know, they tell you it's organic, but unless you go there, how do you really know? So I try really hard to do what I can.
That's
sustainably.
Great. And are you thinking in terms of maybe opening a store? Like, what's your future?
That would be the dream.
That would be the dream, yeah.
Although retail's a little tough right now. But yeah, I think eventually I'd love that. That would be amazing. Then you have direct contact with clients every day. I never realized how important the story was. I just thought if I made something really fabulous that people would want to buy it, but they do love to hear a story.
Yeah, I think any story. I mean, yes, it has become very important, but even in the past, like even in from my background, you know, if you had a story behind a problem, they appreciated it. You know, it's like, why is that going to be late? And you tell them, you know, the story. It's like, oh, wow, I love knowing that. Right. You know, and then they just accept it because it's, you know, it could be information, right, about quality or mm-hmm. whatever.
I just never felt that I had a story. I just thought that I started a business and make bags. And then the more I talk to people, I realize, okay, well, maybe I do have a little story.
Well, and I guess now you can show people everything. Like on Instagram, you know, are you showing how things can be made or scenes from inside the factory or anything like that?
I do that. It's hard because Instagram is glamorous in a way. You show photos of beautiful things. My factory is not glamorous. Mm. It's, you know, we cut. When we're cutting the hides with the hair on, for example, I have to wear a gas mask and glasses because little microfibers of hair, and whatever I wear, by the way, I have to throw away.
Wow.
Because that hair is tiny and it gets into there and then gets into everything. And that's just a function of the cutting. But I don't think anyone wants to see that on Instagram.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, you'd have to stage it.
Make it look good.
Yeah. So what stores do you think, you know, there are a lot of stores that are opening that are kind of multi-brand or different brands. Like
there are.
Where do you go for like inspiration?
Inspiration.
In terms of shopping here or.
I mean,
you mentioned Cooper Hewitt, which.
But yeah.
Actually, I went there recently and thought, how come I never go there? But
it's beautiful, isn't
yeah,
it?
Mm-hmm.
Really sweet. Oh my gosh, inspiration. I don't really get inspiration from stores. Mm. I mean, I love watching and seeing the way they merchandise, but not from a design point of view. Inspiration, New York is just the biggest source of inspiration for everything. I just shot on Monday our fall campaign, and it's a little edgy because I love graffiti. So we went to Chinatown on a dingy old rooftop and shot next to some graffiti, and I just love that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. A beautiful gown, a gorgeous model in a beautiful gown with one of my evening clutches next to some graffiti.
You have to be careful because sometimes you have to license the graffiti from the artist.
Oh.
Brands have gotten in trouble with that.
Seriously?
Really? Yeah. I thought you were kidding.
Yeah, I think... Something happened in Detroit where one of the car companies, they shot a car going past original graffiti some artist had randomly put up of the logo of that car brand with graphics around it. And they got sued by the artist for using their artwork in the commercial, even though the artist had used the logo of the brand
really?
To make their art. Yeah.
Did they countersue?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I can't remember. I think I saw that on the fashion law.
Okay. All right. Then I will.
Yeah, you got to be careful.
Maybe especially edit that.
especially if there's a signature in the corner.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have to think of everything.
Yeah. I think if it's not a specific artwork, if it's very general where people have just scrawled things all over a wall, you're not really in danger there. I think. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty sure.
Oh, wow.
As an artist who has had some experience with these issues.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'll have a look at what we end up using.
So you're based in the Brooklyn
Navy Yard.
What's
fabulous.
Going on over there?
Oh, well, it's just Bill de Blasio has helped to further the movement of putting funds into this area. It's fascinating because during the war, it's where when the men were away fighting the Second World War, women were making ammunition down there.
That's where all the posters came from of the women with the muscles
yes,
working.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And wow, the way security is at the moment getting into the Brooklyn Navy Yard, you'd think we were still making ammunition. Mm. But it's a wonderful area, space, and people. There's a lot of light industry. WeWork just built a huge building there. A lot of tech startups.
Yeah, it's all different business. I just went for the first time. It was a little overwhelming, but
it's large. It's big, yeah. And the buildings are all spaced apart. But it's fabulous. It's
yeah,
really
I
great.
Felt like I was in Hong Kong, actually.
Oh, really?
Well,
not
yeah.
Industry City or the Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Because
Industry
Yard,
City
yeah.
is
no,
also
not
quite
Industry City.
Industry.
Navy, the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Yeah, I went to a knitwear person there. So I guess there's chocolate people there. There's paper people
Sugar.
There. So that's interesting for you to be able to meet so many different kinds of manufacturers.
I should get out and socialize more there, but I don't. I kind of get into my space and, yeah, it's kind of a nice space. And it's close to the city and it's right on the water. And, yeah, I love it. For me, it's a great hub. I can distribute my bags from there and send them everywhere. It works well.
Why, are there little distribution centers in there also?
There actually are. And FedEx and
really?
UPS and DHL, they're always there. The trucks, I'm constantly running after the DHL truck or the UPS truck.
That was a problem with Industry City is that you can't pull a tractor trailer into it. It's built for those kind of short half trucks, the city trucks. So the lanes between the buildings, you can't really back up a tractor trailer to the loading docks,
okay.
Which has been a concern for people. So you don't have big factories in Industry City where you could in the Navy Yard or the Army
do.
Terminal.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm always getting into trouble because I park my car in the loading dock and it's 20 minutes only, but I'm always moving stock around and heading to my stores and moving out colors, and I always have tons of boxes in my car and they're always yelling at me. Oh, sorry, guys.
Wow, you're doing everything. But it's great, though, that the city's doing that. And I think they've given some breaks, right, on rents there and so on to get started. I don't know if I'm making that up, but I think that's what I was told.
You mean for companies?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there have been some subsidies for startups. It's interesting. The New York City Economic Development Corporation has done a lot of work in there. There's a project in Greenpoint. They're all over Brooklyn. They're in Manhattan in different places where you wouldn't think they are. Things are being kind of pushed along slowly, but once they show up, they really show up, like the Hudson Yards project and that sort of thing.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's encouraging, I think.
It is. It is. And we're all, it's interesting because certainly where I'm in building 3, which is the least pretty of all the buildings. It's run down, but you know, you get up and go there in the morning and you see all these other people doing the same thing, and we're all creating something. You know, we're not sitting on a computer offering information. We're creating
right,
a product.
Right.
There's a woodworking yeah. studio mm-hmm. right near me, and they're constantly making sets for, I don't know what for, but it's great to watch them come in and out with their timber. And
yeah, it's exciting. I think, you know, it's great to meet your neighbors there. I think you can collaborate maybe in different ways you never thought of.
Yeah, absolutely. Really fascinating to see. Amazing. And my manufacturer has equipment, beautiful old pieces of equipment that he still uses, that he's had for 30 years to put press studs onto things. And
does he produce for a lot of brands?
He does. He does. Yeah. Yeah. And he does, he does sampling for a lot of big names in the city as well. And he used to in the 80s make leather jackets.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he actually has a wall of leather jackets from the 80s that I keep.
It was probably like Winlet or something. There were some old names in the 80s.
Really?
Yeah. Wow.
Okay.
What are some of the areas that you've gotten into with trying to understand sustainability that you've found interesting? Where do things get weird and where does it get special in terms of making handbags without hurting the environment, without all the labor issues and things like that?
So for me, there was a big push in the beginning to make in China. A lot of people wanted me to do that I was speaking to. And I realized that that wasn't something I wanted to do. I mean, a couple of reasons. One, they have very big minimums and I didn't want to use all my capital in inventory. And the other one was just you don't have the same control over the labor. I mean, I didn't want to think that young people were making my bags. I love that I walk into my factory in Brooklyn and I'm in the same space as the women who are edge painting and gluing and we're all together. So it's not like I'm sitting in some ivory tower designing. We're using the same kitchen and eating this. It's great. I love that. So I feel very much a part of it and very much hands-on. That wouldn't be the same if I were outsourcing to Asia. And in Italy, I go there every 4 months. And again, I see the people making, I meet with my manufacturers and we all sit around and we go out to the leather places. And it's very much something I do with them together. It's time consuming and it probably wouldn't scale very well, but right now it's great.
So it's interesting you're able to produce in Italy and here and still kind of balance out price and quality.
Yeah. Sadly, the labor cost in New York is high, which is why the cost of producing here is high. Mm-hmm. And the Italians are very hungry for work because a lot of their big brands have gone offshore. A lot of the big names say they're made in Italy, but yeah, that's questionable.
They're passed through Italy.
Look, there are a few points that you need to tick. One of them is putting the bag in a dust bag. That counts as one point.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah. Hmm. Anyway, that's a whole other.
Does that entirely qualify something?
No, not entirely.
Oh, you get points. Okay.
Yeah, I think there's four or five. I'm not sure. I don't want to say anything wrong, but there are a few points to be made in Italy. And
interesting.
I like the fact that I'm 100% either made in Italy or 100% made in Brooklyn. And one of the things, though, that's been interesting, when I decided to make in America, I really wanted to find suppliers that were American businesses. So I did. I set about finding, and one of the people I use is a crowd called Buckle Guy. I shouldn't tell all my secrets, really, should I, on a podcast?
You should, because your competitors are manufacturing in China and will not use these suppliers. You want to be friends with people who would use the same supplier as you do.
Okay. So Buckle Guy are a great family-run company, father and son, and they're, I'm so bad with American geography. They're somewhere a few hours away. Anyway, they're fabulous. But they even have some of their products, they have a factory in China. So a lot of businesses that you think are American still have somewhere that are bringing to them from
parts
from
or
China.
Something.
Yeah. So it's difficult to find homegrown, really, that's all American, because it just doesn't really exist so well, not in the luxury space.
Yeah, some things are coming back. I mean, we've got a lot of factories with the lights off where you could really just walk in, clean up, and start making again. But the labor is the issue, and the cost of labor, and just a little bit of reinvestment, I think, is an issue.
In the skill set, you mean?
In training sewers and that sort of thing, but also, fresh paint job, that sort of thing.
Do you think, here I am asking you the questions, but I'm confused by this. Do you think people want to buy local? Do you think there's enough patriotism for people to want to buy American made?
Yes, but if the price is different, they won't.
Right. And that's
they want the price to be the same and then they will choose made in USA.
But that's impossible because
it's not.
Because the labor cost here is so much more than say.
But the transportation cost and the error cost and all these things, they add up.
Mm.
And as wages rise overseas, I mean, that's why you have brands now going to manufacture in places like Ethiopia, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. the labor rates in China have risen.
Yeah.
The cost of labor has risen.
So it's not so far off from here, especially in apparel.
Yeah.
Like you said, the shipping by the time you're done with duty and all that.
I will say for me, when I get a price in Italy, I have to factor in not just the shipping and the duty, but the currency conversion because I pay in euros. So by the time I've added all of that, it's still a little bit cheaper to get it in Italy. And they're skilled for centuries of what they do. It still works out a little bit better to get it made there.
But that happens at scale when you're talking about large volume, right? Because if you're talking about small volume,
yes,
then
yes,
it works here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm. Mm.
I wonder sometimes when I go to the big trade shows here in New York and I see rows and rows and rows of booths with garments that look kind of like something that someone would want to buy, but not quite. Like they're not quite there. They're not quite interesting or special. They're in that direction, but something messed up. I wonder how many of those are communication issues with the factories, if it's people designing remotely and then getting their samples back and the samples look wrong and that's all they've got to go to the trade show. I wonder how often I see that, or whether that's just this is what they were able to pay for and what they want to be in the business of. I don't know. I always have these questions. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, everyone has different tastes. I think that's one of the things I've learned. Recently I had a bag come in and the color, there was a communication issue with the Italians. I said to them, I want dark French navy to go with this brown, chocolate brown stripe. And they said, certo, Lisa, certo, okay. And then when the invoice came, it said Oceana Marrone. So I assumed that Oceana was dark French navy because I had stipulated dark French navy, but I hadn't asked for a swatch or a photo. My mistake. I should have absolutely dotted that I and crossed that T. And when it came in, it was like this. It's a nice blue, but it's not navy.
Once it's here, it's too late.
It's too late once it's here. And yeah, you're right. Maybe that's something like
is
that happens.
Marrone maroon?
Marrone brown.
Brown.
Brown. Oh.
Brown. Mm.
Okay.
So I learned a big lesson. That's one of the lessons I've learned.
Yeah.
I feel like I learn them every day.
Well, that's how everything gets better, really, right?
I wish I'd listened more in math class. I was so bad at math. And now I need it all the time. From converting currency to working out the yield.
Right,
to,
the exact measurements.
The exact measurements of every little thing. And, oh, my gosh, I struggle with that.
But you can ask Siri.
Ask Siri everything.
Yeah.
And Google.
I'm working with a designer now, and he asks Siri everything, including measurements.
Really?
Yeah, it's like, wow, maybe I should get one of those.
No.
Alexa's.
No. I don't trust those things. I don't want that in my house.
Yeah, they listen. They listen to everything.
Yeah, I think some people just don't care. I don't know.
I don't know.
It'd be pretty boring at my house listening to what I have to say. Siri would fall asleep. I could talk a little bit about, you asked about sustainability and I didn't really, I'm so sorry I went on a tangent.
No, it's okay.
One of the things that I found really interesting is that I do have a lot of vegan friends, and I have had a few people say, why don't you make a vegan bag? I wonder whether a vegan is going to buy a vegan bag from a woman who also makes leather bags, or whether that's a statement that they would boycott that entire brand because they're true to what they believe in. So anyway, I started researching what I could use and what vegan leather is, pleather, which is vinyl, which is PVC, which is made from chemicals and is not only harmful to the environment, but harmful to the people that are working with it and making it. So look, there are pros and cons about both, because that's the argument about using leather and tanneries. I use a lot of vegetable tan leather, and veg tan leather is tanned using natural vegetable dyes, and it's a really interesting old process, and they put it into these barrels, and the leather patinas as you use it, it just gets softer and softer and looks better and better. You know, when you've had, I don't know, a bag or a pair of shoes that you've had for years and years, and they look great the more you use them. So anyway, I've been on this journey of discovering. I found this pineapple skin that they're weaving together. Yeah, yeah, to make a kind of leather. However, because it's sort of in that infancy stage, it's more expensive than leather.
Mm.
So then there's that cost issue. Does someone want to pay more for something like that?
And then the vegetable dye, do you have other issues to deal with in terms of performance of that?
No, color? It's fabulous. It's very expensive and it's beautiful leather.
Mm.
And in fact, it's the type of leather, if you scratch it, you just rub it and the scratch sort of comes out. It's really great. They use it a lot for men's shoes and men's it's more rugged. It's not so great for this softness, but I use it in the Weekender.
I think any way to start is the right way to start. And if I'm not mistaken, Gucci has started a small collection that is sustainable in their accessories.
Sustainable meaning not leather? Or
yeah, I think it's not leather. Actually, I saw it like 2 months ago and thought, wow, how are they doing that before taking the whole brand there? Of course, it might have been Burberry and I might be making a mistake. But the bottom line is it was a big brand and it was like, wow, they're just thinking to themselves, they're respecting the fact, you know, people respect the fact that they're starting somewhere.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, we'll have to see who it is.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll look it up. Google or Siri.
Yeah. Siri, yeah.
So where can people find you online?
Canvasandhide.com. I sell online. And
that's Hide with a Y, right?
It's Hide with a Y. The name came because when I started, I'd gone through a really difficult personal stage and it was the blank canvas of my new life. And the Jekyll and Hyde duality of human nature. I was, a few things happened and life changed for me. So I love that juxtaposition.
Yeah, I love it too. That's great.
But a lot of people spell it with an I. I have to correct them. Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much for having
you.
Me.
This is fun.
Thank you for listening to American Fashion Podcast. On our website, AmericanFashionPodcast.com, you can find our Be a Guest form, as well as a sign-up page for invitations to our live shows, and a new feature, The Archives. With roughly 250 episodes published, the old shows don't fit in our feed anymore, so we've made them available for a nominal fee. Please continue the conversation online. On Twitter, we are at AFPOD, and on Instagram, we are at American Fashion Show, and I personally am at Fashion Tech Guru on just about everything. For direct comments, give us a call at 646-979-8709. That's our voicemail line. Or email info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Mouth Media Network, which holds the copyright to this and all other episodes, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends. Keep making things beautiful. Remain in force. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.
This is Mouth Media Network, audio for business.